What a crowd. Am I mic'd okay? Can you hear me back there? John Beck gave me this good luck charm, so I hope it gives you a better poetry reading than you would have had otherwise. The first poem I'm going to read is called Myself as a Member of My Family, and an issue that I wrestle with over and over in my poetry is that issue of personal history, of family connection. What does it mean to have genetic similarity with someone, particularly if you're separated from those people, if there's a lot of dislocation in your family? And I wrote this poem after I read an article in the Lansing State Journal written by a Dr. Ming Sang. And the poem is in the form of a letter to Dr. Sang. There's a quote that begins the poem, which is what Dr. Sang said, which is, once a person knows there is a risk of developing a mental disorder, he can take certain preventative actions. Dear Dr. Sang, you say the odds of becoming schizophrenic if one parent is schizophrenic are 13.8%. Of becoming sociopathic if one parent is sociopathic, 13%. Of becoming manic depressive if one parent is manic depressive, 18%. Are these odds additive? My mother is manic depressive, though previously diagnosed as schizophrenic, but that was before she got rheumatoid arthritis, also heritable, which you claim is incompatible with schizophrenia. Is heritability of rheumatoid arthritis dominant over heritability of manic depression? And since my father is a sociopath, are the odds I will wake one day to find my conscience has vanished 13%? Or do I now only have 13% of the conscience I was meant to have? Or does schizophrenia, sociopathology, and manic depression cancel each other out? 13.8% plus 13% subtracted from 28%, leaving me with just a 1.2 chance of going crazy. If I add up these odds, just directly from my parents, not counting my no-account bankrupt grandfather, they are better than 50-50 that I will soon be institutionalized. What preventative actions do you suggest, assuming I have any free will left after calculating the above percentages? Or when I wind up in a cell in Bellevue or Ishpeming, should I simply be relieved to know none of it is really my fault? I began writing as a fiction writer, and almost all my work has a narrative line, either implied or explicit. And part of that narrative line has to do with evoking certain periods of history. A few of these poems will evoke that period of history at the end of the 40s and the beginning of the 50s, in the aftermath of World War II. This poem is very cinematic, so I invite you to envision it as I read. Post Office, 1952. She stands against the wall, smoking a Lucky Strike, wearing a red suit, now a little shabby, featured 4 years before on the cover of Vogue. The clerk flickers behind the post boxes, a sepia film through the yellowed glass. His arm moves, his hand snaps. Letters thunk diagonal across gold-numbered windows, but not into the box she watches, for the letter that says where to write, where to meet him, what to tell the FBI, that he loves her and the daughter who hopscotches the floor's marble squares. The woman's tongue darts, her finger catches a shred of tobacco as a clerk disappears, sorting done. Her high heels click like her lipstick's ring of keys. She unlocks a tiny door at the level of her daughter's eyes. You look, she says. Through the square, the daughter sees distance, room after room of shelves stacked with packages, bundles of mail. How's the miking, okay? You're okay? Are we gonna have some seats for those folks in back? Hi. Another poem in that same era is called A Gambler's Daughter. And like all war times, World War II was a wild time for the folks that were in it. My father was a pilot in World War II. And some people, like my father, could never really settle down to the ordinary life of the Eisenhower administration after that. A gambler's daughter, quote, "Diamonds big as horse balls, black-tipped sables to match the red in mother's hair, silk stockings and $100 shoes, pompano at Lafitte's baked in a paper bag, catalogs of what we'd have when you hit. Instead of gifts, the second-hand compliments of trainmen and card sharps. How often you showed mother's picture, how they said, 'I'd give it all for a real tomato like that.' Men who'd drawn the right hand, the one that should have been yours and would have been, except for a lurch of the club car, a cheat you trusted. But we'd have it soon, the right bet, a few more days on the deal, the big guy coming in. And mother would soften, shake out her hair, put on the Dorseys, blow the mortgage money on steaks and good gin. Pretty, 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 you'd pinch us, your little tomatoes, naming train stops, deals and odds, the few words in German you picked up during the war. Just what a daughter needed to know, how to mix a dry Gibson, three sour cocktail onions on a toothpick, just how little is a little vermouth. I might have gotten it right, but by then you were gone, laying what you'd caged from the few friends left on a terrific long shot, minutes behind or ahead of schedule, the color of the next woman's shoes. Mother back to the night shift, the bright marks of your mouth blooming like gladiolas on her throat, the whiskery itch of vows made too loud and too close to the ear, the rustle of ginny breath she hears in the distance of any promise." And my mother was indeed quite a tomato. She was a pretty, juicy woman. A beauty queen, a very, very attractive and sexy lady. But poor mothers always end up holding not only the bag for the paying the mortgage and keeping the roof over people's heads and buying the food, but they also get blamed for everything that goes wrong, something I became much more aware of when I became a mother. So now I'm more sympathetic. And not only, when you become a mother, you not only pass down your own genetics and your own like oddities and flaws, but you also pass down the whole culture and the whole physical environment to your child, whatever you've ingested or inhaled. So this poem is called "What a Tomato," and it's for my mother and my son with love. "Thank you for mourning, mother, for the blaze of light that presses our eyes closed, for the wild moments when we throw ourselves off whatever precipice down the long slide that we're still sliding. Thank you for the use of your womb to seed and grow myself in, little parasite fattening on your cushioned walls, to think that I was ever for a second welcome. Who wouldn't get a little crazy? Who wouldn't blaze the lights? Who wouldn't poke away at that pink body plopping out, that needy thing? It bites, it stinks, it draws blood. No one knows how floppy-head helpless this little thing clinging. When you might have been reading Omar Khayyam or stopping hearts of flyboys with your dancing, can-canning your long legs in swirls of parachute silk up Folies Bergères stairs. Dear mother, your body was a good house. Thank you for the space, the cushy blood nest, for the bare light filtering in, sound of heartbeats and string of pearls, your college Chaucer and Bessie Smith. You were the real thing, quite a tomato, a lush, fruity home with only a few poisons, Lucky Strikes and Ramus gin fizzes, distant Hiroshima rads. Thank you for not addicting me to Benny's. Thank you for not drowning me, for small amounts of DDT instead of polychlorides. Thank you for this breath, for this particular light. And for the pains passed down, my own son John, my own pick annoying motherings, my own craziness and slip-ups, everything that was too wild or not enough or not perfect. Please, I ask for your pardon and offer these soft bits of memory to line the womb of forgiveness. This is another poem, a mother poem, and it's a true story. Most of my poetry, when it uses a narrative line, adapts biography and autobiography, but this, in this poem, the events in this poem really happened, and it's called The Temperature of Breast Milk, which is body temperature. I terrified a professor once with breast milk. He'd come to see the baby, and I had a diaper ready to cover myself against his sensibilities. But as I unbuttoned my blouse, my son screamed from waiting and startled out the milk. It arced 8 feet across the room, a high curve that held the air like foam on the crest of a wave, and hung. Until my son, still a natural, not too young for amazement, nuzzled and took the breast. Milk pooled the corners of his mouth, then bubbled over down his chin, while the professor ran out the door as if from a haunting. I'm a professor myself now, and the age when I can't bear children or make milk. I hate it. No matter how much you practice or time heating a bottle, you're never sure it won't scald your baby's mouth or give him chills, except by feel. But you can count on breast milk. It's one of the few things anymore to work right. Thanks. This is the title poem of the book, Spatial Relations, and its images again date back to the time I was in junior high school. That is the late 50s, and that was the last time when we had an extensive program of testing in our public schools that was of course guaranteed to improve the quality of education in this country. Just look at us and you'll see how well it worked the last time. We were the first generation to have those number two pencils and fill in those little things on the scoring sheets. And one of the tests we had to take were aptitude tests, and they were going to find out what you weren't going to be good at and stop you from trying it, I guess. But there were subtests. I mean, they tested your clerical speed and accuracy and your mathematical reasoning, et cetera. And one of the things they tested was spatial relations. And in the test of spatial relations, you see a one-dimensional figure that's more or less a blueprint of something that could be constructed, and you have to pick the example that shows what it would look like if it were actually constructed. Women aren't supposed to be any good at this. But women sew, and sewing is a pretty complicated task of spatial relations. Spatial relations. Remember the geometric forms on aptitude tests? Combinations of cubes and cones the questions asked us to upend and rotate, or turn inside out, or trapezoids and rhomboids we were to fold so we could choose the figure they would make assembled. I fingered 6 sides of my pencil, trying to squeeze my eyes smart for this piece of engineering zanier than building a dress, matching right sides to right, and trying to imagine it turned inside out and backward from the way it was in my hands to become a pocket or a sleeve. When my brain failed from parallelograms that might fold in to make a prism, I blinked up at the other 8th graders hunched over booklets spread on cafeteria tables, all of us spaced 2 seats apart so we couldn't cheat and claim an aptitude that wasn't ours. Van, who's dead now, Richard in his immaculate white pants, Cookie finger-pressing pleats in her cheerleader skirt, Eva, who couldn't read, biting off bits of her eraser and examining them in her palm as if they were the test. Then the monitor chalked 0 over a smudged 5 to show minutes left, said time, booklets closed, and I looked down and tried to take the edges up, to stick and paste one tab into one slit, as if the pattern of lines were a child's punch-out cardboard house. My eyes stuttered and my mind stuttered back, and at once I could see the figure they would be as the plain shapes folded themselves in and stood up on the page in solid geometry, and a little, but not at all clearly, the spaces neither figure nor margin, which hung in the blurred wakes of their folding. I probably fell asleep during that test. That's why I'm not an engineer today. But schoolrooms invite us to sleep, and I have to say that as a teacher, sometimes my students begin to nod out a little bit, especially in the late afternoon and spring. And in this poem, I try to recreate that sensation of a room in which people are sort of, their eyes are closing. They're trying to stay awake. And in the meantime, various strange images are passing through their minds. You may lose your way in this poem in the same way you lose your way when you're having those kind of thoughts, but just stick with us. We'll get back to it. It'll come back together in the end. Cichlids are tropical fish, for those of you who don't know, and Tanganyika and Malawi are two lakes in which certain cichlids have developed, and they exist only in those particular places. They're very brightly colored fish. Fish spring window. These students, dopey with spring, their heads bob over the text like droopy mums. Behind their wavering eyelids, there's more to see. As glancing out your window, you might glimpse a cloud of sparrows flitting between trees, or even a veldt where zebras prance in tall grass instead of Cincinnati. Something real or imagined snatching your attention, like the moment when you are not exactly first in love, but just after that, when you suddenly can't believe your luck. Or like the moment I woke up after my son was born, his head pointy from forceps. No matter how flat his forehead was, he was so beautiful. Or my husband watching the fish dart and flash in his aquarium, the African cichlids who evolved their own near marine colors, sequestered in the rift lakes Tanganyika and Malawi, an underwater Galapagos. He overcrowds them, so there's no room for territoriality. Still, they bump one another with their snouts when they cross paths. Who is big enough to eat whom? Mapping the space they take, a paisley of motion. A pattern you can almost see if you know it's there in the near invisible water. The way I see bits of my students' dreams as bright flashings over their bored-looking heads, all of us improbably jammed together in this room against nature, like flickers of tiny northern lights in cardinal, gold, turquoise, a red empress, a peacock, an electric blue, run amok auras, some more than a little cannibal, but all shimmery as aquarium fish or the rainbow halos of circus angels. I spend a lot of time teaching, and I not infrequently write poems about my students. This poem is not from the Spatial Relations manuscript. It's from a new series I'm doing. I had a grant this fall, institutional research grant from Michigan State, to work on a long poem based on the goddess Inanna and other goddess figures, and this is part of that series. This poem is about a student in a class in which we spent a lot of time trying to find the language to describe things. And we would often go outside Bessie Hall by the Red Cedar, where the canoe club ties up their canoes, and we look at the river and try to write about it. So this captures that. It's called Silver Canoes and Cowrie Shells. Isis is an Egyptian goddess, a major Egyptian goddess. Iris is not only the flower, but a goddess of the rainbow, Greek goddess of the rainbow. And Ibis is a water bird, much like a crane. Silver canoes and cowrie shells. It's an 18th birthday poem for my student Iris, singer, songwriter. We're on the riverbank, hunting metaphor in a silver chevron of tethered canoes, opening and closing like feathers, an egret stretching her wing, ribbons of willow leaf signaling from the opposite bank, last bright light flaring before dusk. When there you are, dressed in a black linen sheath, at your neck a white suede pouch, a string of creamy cowrie shells opening their mouths as if to sing. Iris, white ibis, it's your birthday, you tell us, the first ever without mother to wake you with a birthday song. And you've waited all day for your father to call, but he never calls. If we had known it was your birthday, we would have brought you ice white cake and tangerines, sage to scent your dough of a pouch, would have given you a birthday ride on a silver canoe, a bright angel circlet to wear giddy over your black hair. Iris, I have no gift, just this. There is no end to longing, Iris, and you feed it every second you wait. Cast a cowrie oracle, honor the goddess of rivers, study Iris and Isis and Ibis. Look at pictures of a white bird perched on one reedy leg, and know she is your sister. And if you must wait, don't squander this filigree, yours alone, your sadness, the fading light, the silent phone. Reach for your guitar. Something else that often comes up in my poems is a tension between scarcity and excess, and I think you hear that in those childhood poems. In my childhood, it was a lot or nothing. And so I think that issue still runs through things I write. And this poem is from a longer poem called Eating Red Meat, and it's dedicated to Diane McCoskey. Diane has beautiful red meat sliced on a yellow wooden platter. Just the sight of it makes me ravenous for blood. Just the sight of the black capers and the yellow mustard, the gold crusts on the Roma bread, make me ravenous for meat. All the books in a row, the millions of poems here, the bottles of special occasion wine, make me ravenous for meat. The crocus shoots in the white bowl, the bushmills, the cream whipped so thick I would suffocate if I put my face in it. All these people saying poems make me ravenous for meat. Something about this house reminds me of the nursery teacher's report when I was 4. Her table manners are horrible. She eats as if someone is trying to take the food away from her. And on the same theme, when I was small, I had imaginary playmates, and now as an adult, I still do. This poem is sort of the intersection between reality and imagination. The florist's wife feasting. Admit it, I want to say to the florist's wife. When you drank wine from your boyfriend's patent leather shoe and nibbled his boutonniere, you kept a piece of the fluted petal inside your lip like Copenhagen, not knowing you were starting a habit you couldn't get rid of. I've been dreaming of a woman taken by the scent of a carnation, the band playing Taste Your Lips of Wine, anytime, night or day, that taste and smell gang up on her, the scents of flowers call her like ghosts. Now, quickly, put each petal into your mouth. The florist's wife eats snapdragons like popcorn, scrapes gardenias with her teeth, as if they were artichoke leaves. She chews the edges of Queen Anne's lace and her tongue grows long and thin from sticking it into calla lilies. She puts bunches of lilacs into her mouth hole like someone at an orgy swallowing a bunch of grapes at one gulp, though I can't imagine them going down the throat, just the waiting tongue, the open mouth, the purple French lilacs held over it. I saw you, I want to say to her, at your grandmother's funeral, picking the long hollow tubes off the pom-poms and eating them like little bananas. She marries the florist out of the worst motives, letting him think it's his mustache she loves. Or maybe they are the only motives, hunger and wanting all she can get of what she wants. How shocked the florist is and horror-stricken to find her stupefied among geraniums, coral petals dotting her lips. They go on this way for a while, like addicts of anything in their spouses. He tries to understand this is a disease. She buries half-gnawed stems in the compost heap. He helps her cut down to just one poppy a day, as a woman might buy for her husband one pair of silk panties after coming upon him trying to get into her lingerie. She slips out of bed to nibble cymbidiums. Then Mary comes to my house with lilacs, picks one flower at a time and sucks to get the syrup out, heaping paled blooms in front of her, stems stacking up on my table like chicken bones. And she does this so ordinarily, so matter-of-factly, so unlike the florist's wife, who, driven mad by the scent of an opening rose, slips the key to the walk-in from around the sleeping florist's neck and is found by him among pails that held gladiolas, among mangled leaves and snapped stems, 100 carnation boutonnieres gone, flowers for 6 weddings and funerals devoured, leaving bits of green tape and the pearl-headed pins from all the mother's corsages that promise how I'll gorge once I start to feast on flowers. Thank you. Eating all those lilacs makes my mouth dry. I like to experiment in my writing a lot, and one of my experiments was to pick random pieces of text and then write poems about it. It's a Faculty X series. It's a chapbook from Years Press. And I'd open this book, a book by Colin Wilson called The Occult. I'd stick my finger in it. I'd pick a phrase, and then I'd write a poem based on that phrase. Sometimes the way I used the phrase was different from the way it was in the book. For example, for this poem, the original phrase was, there was a slip which set off an avalanche. So in the original, it was a slip of the foot, but in my poem, it's underwear, women's underwear. This is also based on my observation of how men look when they go into stores and try to shop for their wives or girlfriends in lingerie departments called lingerie. Among heaps of women's pastel panties, he knew he was in a place foreign as any country. The way the clerk smiled, as you would at a child who has slipped into the middle of the street. In her eyes, a look of inside knowledge and also warning that among the brassieres he might find things he did not want to know. Even the language was strange to him. Teddies, camisoles, demibras, corselettes, all this diminutive and the long vowels among clouds of slips and the swishing of satin and taffeta, things he could not match to objects in the world. He felt immured in all this silk and saw at the clerk's neck a tape measure, ready to take his measure, as if she knew something about him he did not know about himself, as she offered help among the loungewear and negligees. As he fingered through the racks, threads snagging rough spots on his thumbs, the gown hems brushed his ankles as if they were the hands of invisible women trying to pull him under to them, and he felt he was in a jungle hunting something that was also hunting him. The clerk, with her snake of a tape, asked if he wanted a gift, and he said nothing. No, yes, because in this woman's place, feeling so alone and brave to be here, He was hoping he might find or be found by a woman, silky and soft, but deadly, dangerously lovely, inside his own skin. February is coming up, and my husband's birthday is in February. A few years ago, I wrote this poem for him, for his birthday, because of a remark he made after a poetry reading. And we were walking out of a poetry reading, and he said something that stimulated this poem called Black Leather. A birthday poem for my husband, Roger, who, after a dull poetry reading, says he wants to quit his job and buy a Harley. Back then, our life was one sprawly, wild poem. Not quite howl, but ranty that way. People in and out of the house, someone with a fifth of tequila passed out in the bathroom, a lot of foot traffic and attractive strangers, heavy breathing, jealousy and visiting poets liberating vodka from the 7-Eleven and having to be bailed out. All punctuated with premenstrual dramas and love crises, strikes and hot, exciting politics. Remember the poetry reading on the Union lawn when John 5 slept under a blanket until I came on, then he stood up to cheer and yell? Someone read from a shopping cart and threw burnt toast, and the guy who couldn't get his poems published mistook me for the literary establishment and gave me the finger. When the drunk poet from Ann Arbor kept licking tongues with our Airedale. How he tried to talk the whole van load of poets into committing mass suicide on the way home. Remember Norman Hinley in the Union Tower? Did he have a gun? And Casey Bush ranting on about train headlights. How about Diane Wachowski cursing her false lovers? And who could forget Lee Upton's riddle poem? Why do dogs roll in dead animals? Because the live ones won't let them. All reckless and kiss-off, full of lefty politics, like Ansem Hallow's poem, The Boss, I'd rather work for a cauliflower. Or Rose's invisible slideshow about her migrant worker family. You had to watch carefully because they were so briefly there. Then there was Sam Mills' attack on capitalism in Miami Beach. Hotel, 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 hotel. And these were just the things said in public in front of large audiences. There was always something to protest, and poetry that was more than pretty and sweet, more than witty or slightly snotty, something worth raising your voice over. Elbowing the bounds of good taste and decorum to put words to things that really scared us or made us deeply ashamed. Our mixed-up way of approaching the sacred, something to curse, confess, transgress, something in the Oval Office to protest more villainous than a fly unzipped. But even then, we had no Harley. We had no money, but always seemed to find enough for chili and beer. Now we're so sober in every way, when the crowd at the poetry reading disperses, no one remembers what was read, except it was nice. The few remaining who have stood it this long eat a cookie, drink a cup of almond decaf, and we all go home to watch TV. No wonder you want a Harley. Isn't anyone following my old advice? Break something made of glass every single day? Why would we? It would only make a mess. We'd have to clean up ourselves. You still look good in black leather, but now we know brain surgeons and nurses who work with closed head injury. If you saw how fragile the brain is, how no helmet is near as good as an intact skull, they tell us, you'd never ride a motorcycle, not on your life. Knowledge is caution, prudence, the willingness to settle on a Vespa. It's snoozy and quiet at home with dogs, and I'm so glad not to be dead like Bob Neamy, to have medical insurance, to be able to pay the bills. Still, sometimes, like today, I feel the wild hope buried under my Land's End sweater, that today we will hear the poem that blows the tops of our heads off, the poem that stops clocks and starts engines, the poem that makes everything new. If you hear it, call me. We'll go there. In the meantime, I offer you this poem. Take it. Let it be your Harley. Ride it toward our inevitable end. It's going to be wild, I tell you. It's going to be wild. I'm going to read two more poems that are not in the spatial relations book. As some of you may know, our granddaughter, Jane Marie Anderson, was diagnosed with leukemia in the spring. And, of course, this is the worst nightmare anybody can imagine for parents or grandparents. Thankfully, she has great care at Children's Hospital of Michigan in Detroit. She's in remission, and the prognosis is very promising. Nevertheless, she has 2.5 to 3 years of very arduous chemotherapy, and it prevents her from hanging around with other kids because her immune system is compromised. Because she can't be with other children, she's developed some alternative companions. I don't know if any of you have ever seen the VeggieTales movies. In VeggieTales movies, they're Bible stories and moral tales that feature, I don't know if you can see these guys, they're very important guys, feature Bob the Tomato and Larry the Cucumber, okay? And these have become, Bob and Larry are her fast friends, and she talks to them all the time and has games with them and so on. This poem is called Michigan Children's Hospital of Detroit, the sixth floor, which is the children's cancer floor. And it's prefaced by a description. In the VeggieTales video, Larry Boy and the Rumor Weed, the hero, a cucumber, struggles to destroy a rumor that has taken root and is spreading uncontrollably. On the windowsill, among books and videotapes, two Barbies tangle feet in air, tented with a hot stench of melted creosote. Behind them, on the top of the next building, two men in mustard-brown Carhartts try to fix a roof leak. Now and then, from the wall behind her bed, jackhammering and thuds of dropped tools from futile elevator repair. In the bed, cadmium fluid creeps up the IV line, spiraling through loops of tubing on folds of skimpy muslin sheet, oozing toward this port sewn into her chest, that drumhead of skin stretched over the valve which leads to the conduit driven into the artery next to her heart. From the television, Larry Boy and the Rumor Weed playing on the VCR. Again, again, she says, each time she wakes from stupor and vomits into the tan kidney of her spitting bowl. More and more of a story she barely understands, but in which right triumphs over something overgrown, monstrous, and huge. Since Jane Marie's been ill, we've been very grateful for the prayers and all other kinds of spiritual or cosmic work people have done on her behalf. And because I've been on working on this grant with goddess figures, I've become very much aware how much of the supplication in the history of the human race has been made to female figures, especially for healing, supplication for healing. Kuan Yin is a Buddhist goddess of compassion. Kali is Indian. Erishkigal and Inanna are Sumerian goddesses, which predate the Old Testament by 3,000 to 4,000 years. And this poem also draws on the language of a sickness, like any sickness. Leukemia has its own vocabulary. This is called acute lymphocytic leukemia, and it's prefaced with the epigraph is, leukemia is the meeting of life and death enacted in the human body. It is destruction and healing warring. And this is for my granddaughter Jane Marie and her doctor, Dr. Savasan. Goddesses and ancestors, I call on your terrible aspects for witness and sword. Inanima, your battlements and scourges, the relentless flaying of your enemies, drive out this horde. Methotrexate, your mace, L-asparaginase, your axe, vincristine, your scalding cauldrons pour down in ruin on your enemies' heads. Snake goddess, squat, ochre, flat-headed, unearth these white grubs, mutant leukocytes, and every labyrinth of liver, spine, and spleen. Sow mother, root, and snout devour them. Kali, death mother, crush the hordes of white demons that smother her blood. Kuan Yin, lend compassion to the cold hands of the surgeon. Mercurius, alchemical, let their terrible poison sit lightly near her heart. Mother Mary, intercede for her. Steady the hand of the nurse who spikes the hollow needle home into her hip bone, who pierces her spine. Clear the mind of the technician who measures the solutions. Remove greed from the pharmacist. Make mindful the attendants. Infuse her blood with oxygen, multiply her platelets, let diploids mend her chromosomes, mature her leukocytes, spare her from neutropenia, destroy her blood enemies, and bring her safely home. Thank you.